He couldn't bring himself to wake her, in order to give her the worst news she would probably ever hear. He stroked her forehead, slightly damp, and kissed it lightly. "I love you," he said. They should have been his last words to Nancy. But he had been too taken up in the awful final struggle to say anything to her. Viola stirred and muttered something, but didn't wake. 2012. Love, mercy, pity, peace. The Queen was sailing slowly down the Thames.
"The Queen," Viola said. "She's on the television."
She was keeping her interpretation of events simple. The flotilla on the river, the rain, the admirable perseverance of monarchy.
"You can't really see the television, though, can you?"
She talked very loudly and slowly to Teddy, as if he was a particularly stupid child. She was sitting next to his bed in one of the care home's high-backed armchairs. It always disturbed her to sit in this chair. It was meant for the elderly, and she dreaded being counted amongst that number now that she was old enough to qualify for saga holidays and lunch clubs in church halls, old enough to wear beige anoraks and pull on slacks. As if. She was old enough to move into Fanning Court, God forbid. Teddy could no longer sit in the chair. He could no longer leave the bed, no longer do anything. He was approaching the end of his twilight, entering into the final darkness. Viola imagined the synapses in her father's brain flaring and dimming, like the slow death of a star. Soon Teddy would burn out completely and implode and become a black hole. Viola was hazy on the subject of astrophysics, but she liked the image. He was labelled, a plastic hospital bracelet around his wrist. Sonny and Bertie had both worn them in the maternity ward. Other people kept things like that. First baby teeth, first shoes, primitive nursery paintings, school reports, regarding them as precious relics of childhood. But Viola had managed to discard everything as she went. Yes, she regretted it, all right? DNR, it said on Ted's plastic bracelet, indicating he had lingered on, long past his sell-by date. Oh, God, life was awful. A memory of last night came back to her, although the memory of last night hadn't ever gone away. She shuddered at it now. She had embarrassed herself dreadfully. Humiliated would be a better word. She had arrived in York from Harrogate in the evening, hoping to see some friends. Yes, she did have friends, against the odds. She was going to phone them and say casually, "How about meeting up? A drink?" Pretending it was an impromptu idea, when in fact she'd been planning it for several days. She was trying to be more spontaneous. What she thought of as spontaneity in her earlier years, she now recognised as mere torpor.
"Shall we go to the beach?"
"Yeah, okay."
She was also trying to revive a social life that she had once had, but which she had woefully neglected since her success.
"So busy with stuff. Sorry."
She hadn't seen these particular friends for a long time, years and years, and they had parted on rather bad terms. They had all been in a women's whole food cooperative, which basically meant that they bought big ugly sacks of chaff and husks, masquerading as muesli, and then divided it up between them. They didn't have much in common, apart from the Steiner School and CND, which sounded like a lot, but wasn't for Viola. Arriving in York, she realised that she had forgotten that it was both a Saturday and a bank holiday weekend, and found York bedecked in jubilee adornment, a frenzy of bunting and red, white and blue. Weekends were also when the city was besieged by rampaging hordes of stags and hens, coming down from the even more northern north. She checked in to the Cedar Court Hotel, which used to be the headquarters of the North Eastern Railway. Everything became a hotel eventually. Dust and sand and hotels. She had hoped for a room with a view, one of the ones that faced onto the bar walls, but there were none available. If she was in a Forster novel, she would meet the love of her life at this point. She would also be 40 years younger, and be wrenched emotionally, and at the end she would have her view. Not that she wanted to be wrenched emotionally. She had given up men, nor indeed meet the love of her life, but she would have liked a view. The girl who checked her in at reception had almost certainly never heard of Forster, although she might have heard of Viola Romain, but Viola didn't feel up to testing that theory. Viola felt as if she spent her life wading through a sea of ignorance, shallow but without a shore in sight. Yes, she was making elitist assumptions. No, she didn't have a right to. The receptionist, who had heard of neither Forster nor Viola Romain, but had enjoyed 50 Shades of Grey, a fact that would have made Viola apoplectic, handed her a key card and said she would get someone to show her to her room.
"Anything else I can do for you, Mrs. Romain?"
After the divorce, Viola had kept Wilf's name, and half the proceeds from the sale of the house, of course, on the grounds that it was more interesting than the prosaic Todd.
"How do you spell Romain, like the lettuce?" someone asked her the other day.
Her father's aunt, the writer of those endless, ghastly Augustus books, had taken the name Fox, much nicer than a lettuce. Why hadn't she thought of that? Viola Fox. Perhaps she could use it as a pseudonym, write a different kind of book, a serious one that didn't sell but was critically lauded. A text that challenges our epistemological assumptions about the nature of fiction. TLS. They had married a month after first meeting. "An immense passion," Viola explained to her disappointed yet strangely envious women's group. Passion was a word that appealed to Viola, the word possibly more than the passion itself. It was doomed and Bronte-esque, and she felt she hadn't had enough of that in her life. She yearned for the romantic. It was neither passion nor romance with Wilf Romain, merely wishful thinking. Wilf Romain had seemed a firebrand, but it turned out that really he was just bombastic. He was polemical, a political activist, CND, Labour Party, etc., who made much of being the son of a coal miner. But as Viola felt it necessary to point out to him not long into their marriage, being the son of a coal miner didn't actually make you a coal miner yourself. Instead, he was a lecturer in communications, a meaningless discipline, at a further education college, with type 2 diabetes and a drink problem. He had seemed fierce and noble, but in the end, he was as disappointing as everyone else.
"Did he hit you?"
Gregory, her therapist, asked. Gregory was very keen on domestic violence as cause and effect.
"Yes," Viola said,
because that sounded infinitely more interesting than the cold, damp truth of mutual indifference. As you got older and time went on, you realized that the distinction between truth and fiction didn't really matter because eventually everything disappeared into the soupy, amnesiac mess of history. Personal or political, it made no difference. Her children left home and she moved to Whitby, although technically Sunny didn't leave home. Viola did. That was when she became a writer. Even Viola had to acknowledge that she needed to shake herself out of her indolent state of mind, engage with the realities of life, which was the kind of thing the voice of reason would say, of course. Writing felt like something she knew, although she only knew it from the other side, reading, and it took her a while to realize that writing and reading were completely different activities. Polar opposites, in fact. And just because she could do joined-up handwriting, she discovered, didn't mean that she could write books. But she persevered, perhaps for the first time in her life. She had had a good apprenticeship, early reader, only child, semi-orphan, and a nature that was essentially voyeuristic. As a child, she had loitered in doorways, listening and observing. "Writers are just vultures." People's Friend, 2009. Sparrows at Dawn was sent to an agent, who rejected it, and then another one and another one, until finally one wrote back and said it was interesting, and although the agent made interesting sound like an insult, she did nonetheless sell it to a publisher, who made a modest 2-book deal, And less than a year later, Sparrows at Dawn was a solid, tangible item in the phenomenal world, rather than a jumble of ideas in Viola's head.
What next? Bertie said to Teddy. Badgers for breakfast, rabbits at bedtime.
Her father did not seem as impressed by this achievement as she would have liked. She had sent him an early proof copy, and then, on publication day, had come over to York, where he took her out for a meal and, surprisingly, ordered champagne to celebrate. But his critique of the novel was lacking in enthusiasm. She had wanted him to be overwhelmed and astonished by her talent, instead of the "very good," he awarded it, managing to make it sound like the opposite. He also failed, apparently, to understand that the book, young girl, brilliant and precocious, troubled relationship with her single-parent father, etc., was about them. Surely he knew that. Why didn't he say something? Instead, on the way back to his house, he sang, "And that singular anomaly, the lady novelist, I don't think she'd be missed, I'm sure she'd not be missed," as if the whole thing was amusing. "Gilbert and Sullivan," he said. "I've got a little list." "Haven't we all?" she thought. Sparrows at Dawn had limited success. Overly sentimental, rather baggy. She had written herself into a hole, but she wrote herself out again with her second novel, The Children of Adam, a bittersweet tragicomedy about life in a commune in the 60s. She had backdated her experiences to a more fashionable decade, and told it from the point of view of a 4-year-old child. "But isn't that my story, not yours?" Bertie said, rather aggrieved. It was hugely popular. "For some reason," Bertie puzzled to Teddy, and was made into a very English and largely forgotten film with Michael Gambon and Greta Scacchi. And that was that, the beginning of her brilliant career. Her bedroom at the Cedar Court was large and rather dark, and must have once been someone's office. She phoned the friends she had thought to meet up with, and found that their phone number no longer worked, which was an indication of how long it was since she'd been in touch. To be honest, she was trying more of that, too. She was relieved. All that catching up they would have been forced to do, and she had moved on so far from those days, and they probably hadn't. If she thought about them, she imagined them still dressed in thick jumpers and long skirts with clogs on their feet, curtains of hair hanging down over their faces, still dishing out horse feed from sacks, although actually one was a barrister in North Square and the other one was dead. She lay down on the hotel bed and stared at the ceiling. It was only 6 o'clock, and the summer evening light would, depressingly, go on forever. She could lie here and stare at the ceiling or watch television and order room service. Neither appealed, so she decided to brave a Saturday bank holiday evening in York, not a light undertaking. At least it wasn't a race day, an event that also attracted large groups of inappropriately dressed young women who could be distinguished from the regular hens by their fascinators, a ludicrous item of headgear if ever there was one. And they were all so fat. How did they manage in toilet cubicles and cinema seats? You could be squashed to death by one of them if you weren't careful. It was early yet, but when she left the hotel, Viola discovered that the stags and hens were already out in force, already astonishingly drunk. She shuddered to think what kind of state they would be in later. Some of the stags were in fancy dress. A whole group, a bunch, she should call them, she supposed, of men dressed in banana costumes were streaming down the steps into the Slug and Lettuce by the river. Most, though, were just in blokey uniform, clean jeans and T-shirts, reeking of aftershave, muscle already turning to flab. The girls were tribal, wearing T-shirts that picked out their affiliations in rhinestones. Claire's Hen Party, Hens in the City, The Only Way is Darlington. The last, a particularly deluded group, in Viola's opinion. Pink was the order of the day for the girls. Pink cowboy hats, pink T-shirts, pink tutus, pink sashes. They were the kind of girls who thought cupcakes were sophisticated. Cupcakes were another bugbear of Viola's. They were just buns, for heaven's sake. Why all the fuss?
To make money, of course. She caught sight of the Dealey boppers, pink, naturally, on the heads of a flock of girls, Hannah's horny hens, who were flapping around at the traffic lights on Lendal Bridge, uncertain where to take their patronage next. Viola hadn't seen Dealey boppers since the '80s. Bertie had a pair when she was a child, silver tinsel balls that bobbed around on her little head like insect feelers. And, Viola suddenly remembered, a pair of spangled silver wings that went with them. A moth, not a butterfly, Bertie said. A little jab to the heart. You had to be careful of the jabs. If you had enough of them, they could weaken the fabric of the heart, open up fault lines, fissures and rifts, and before you knew where you were, the whole brittle structure could shatter into 1,000 tiny pieces. Viola's heart was being held together by sticking plaster and glue. Was that a good image? She wasn't sure. Bertie, against Viola's advice, had insisted on sleeping in her silver wings. The next morning, when she discovered they were crushed beyond repair, she had sobbed inconsolably. "Well, you should have listened to me, shouldn't you?" Viola had said. "I told you that would happen." "Sow and reap, Viola. Sow and reap." Bringing up the rear of Hannah's horny hens, there was a couple of older, rather disconsolate-looking women. A mother of the bride, and an aunt, or prospective mother-in-law, perhaps. Their sagging bodies struggled uncomfortably with the tight pink T-shirts, let alone the rhinestone epithet inscribed across their wobbling bosoms. "Good corsetry," Viola Remain confides conspiratorially. "That's the secret to looking good for the older woman." Sunday Express, Life and Style, 2010. That was not what she said, completely misquoted. Would this be herself one day, Viola wondered? After all, Bertie might decide, in her own post-ironic fashion, to have a traditional hen night, Bertie's Babes, and inflict humiliation on her retinue. She would have to meet someone to marry first, of course. It was beginning to look as if Viola would never know the redemption of being a grandmother. Sunny may as well have been a monk, from the sound of it, and Bertie didn't seem to date at all. Or if she did, she certainly didn't tell her mother about it. Hannah's horny hens seemed to come to an unspoken decision, and the bevy wheeled away down Rougier Street. As they passed in front of her, Viola realized, to her embarrassment, that the wobbling dealy boppers she was staring at were actually stubby little penises. Without warning, the penises lit up and began to flash, and the hens cawed raucously at each other. Viola found herself blushing as she hurried on to the familiar comfort of Betty's. A sanctuary from dystopia, a reliably clean, well-lighted place. She ate a chicken salad and drank two glasses of wine. She was no longer a vegetarian. It was difficult to stay slim on all those pulses. A man was playing the piano. Very well. Not just the usual lounge songs, but some Chopin and Rachmaninoff. Chopin reminded Viola of her mother, and always made her horribly sad. Viola gave up piano lessons after Nancy's death. If she'd kept them up, she might have had a musical career, a concert pianist. Well, why not? Viola went downstairs to the toilets. There was a fragment of a mirror down there, the mirror that used to be behind the bar when this was Betty's bar during the war. The RAF crews used to scratch their names on the glass. Her father had told her about Betty's bar, how he used to drink here during the war, but she hadn't really listened to his reminiscences. Now the mirror was a relic. Nearly all of these men who had left their names behind would be dead now. Many of them would have died during the war, Viola supposed. She peered at the near-illegible names. Had her father left his name behind here? She wished she had asked him about his war when he was still compos mentis. She might have been able to use his memories as the basis of a novel, one that everyone would respect. People always took war novels seriously. When she sat back down at her table, she found that a group of men dressed as condoms were staggering across St. Helen's Square. They were in one of the best-preserved medieval cities in Europe, and they were dressed as condoms. What was wrong with Benidorm? Or Magaluf? "You want everyone to behave better. But you don't behave better yourself, Bertie said. One of the condom men squashed himself like an insect against the large plate glass of Betty's and leered at the diners. The pianist glanced up from his keyboard and then continued serenely with Debussy. A van drew up in the centre of St. Helen's Square and disgorged several people dressed as zombies. The zombies proceeded to chase the men who were dressed as condoms. The condom men didn't seem very surprised, as if they were expecting to be chased by zombies.
They pay for it, Bertie said.
Was this fun? Viola despaired. It was possible, she thought, that she had won the race to reach the end of civilization. There was no prize, obviously. But not quite yet. The finishing line was in sight, but Viola was still to stumble over it. She left Betty's and negotiated her way back across Lendal Bridge, where the atmosphere was decidedly rowdier now. Somehow or other, she became accidentally entangled with Amy's single ladies, a brood who were utterly dishevelled by drink, and being led by the eponymous Amy herself, tiara askew, a sash across a cheap bustier proclaiming her the bride, and an L-plate attached to her not insignificant rump. What had happened to girls? Was this what Emily Davison had thrown herself beneath a horse for? So girls could wear light-up penises on their heads and eat cupcakes. Really? Every time they encountered a male of the species, they each held up a finger and screamed, "Put a ring on it!" before hanging on to each other because they were collapsing with the humour of it. "I'm going to wet myself!" one of them shrieked. A herd of stags streamed around Viola. "Cheer up, you old bag!" one of them yelled at her. "You might get lucky if you stop looking so miserable." Viola stomped on, a boiling fury inside, the cracks and fissures spreading, crazing the surface of her heart. She was an overstrung piano, all the wires about to rupture and spring apart in a dreadful cataclysm of metaphors. How could people be so stupid and ignorant? "Why are you so angry all the time?" Sunny asked her long ago. "Why not?" she snapped. And why didn't her children love her? Why did no one love her? And why was she so lonely and bored and, let's face it, downright wretched? And she went flying, tripping on a paving slab, landing heavily, bone on stone, on her hands and knees, like a leaden cat, everything in her head silenced by the shock for a moment. Her knees hurt so much she didn't want to move. Were her kneecaps broken? A stag made some ribald comment about the position she was in, and a ripe, Geordie accent, a woman, told him to fuck off. Viola sat back, kneeling on the pavement, knees screaming. A pink T-shirt appeared at eye level. Rhinestones spelled out, "Sluts go nuts in York." A woman, a girl really, younger than her smoker's voice, her face smiley and concerned, hunkered down next to Viola and said, "Are you all right, pet?" Not really, Viola thought. Not at all. She burst into tears, right there on the stones of York, her expensive Walford tights ripped, her knees raw and bloody. She couldn't stop. It was awful. Tears retched out of her insides, as if she suddenly tapped into some ancient aquifer of grief. But it wasn't just the tears that horrified her. It was the words that came out of her mouth. The primeval howl, the alpha and omega of all human invocation. Not a howl, but a whimper. "I want my mother," she whispered. "I want my mother."
"You can have mine, pet,"
someone said, and the hens all burst into laughter. But nonetheless, sensing a woman ruined, possibly by drink, possibly not, the hens closed ranks and clustered protectively around her. Someone helped her to her feet. Someone else passed a tissue. A third passed a bottle of Evian that turned out to contain neat vodka. One of the older hens, a broiler with a wrinkled neck and a face that seemed to have collapsed, and who was wearing a T-shirt declaring her to be mother of the bride, handed Viola a pack of wet wipes. They ascertained where she was heading, and she was shepherded tenderly back to Cedar Court by her posse of sluts.
The doorman made a futile attempt to stop them breaching his defences, but they were already pouring over the threshold and spilling into the foyer. Viola fumbled for her keycard, and one of the hens lifted it up triumphantly and waved it at the nervous receptionist.
"She's a bit tired and emotional," one of the hens explained. "Poor old thing,"
a young one, a spring chicken, said.
"Old thing. I'm only 60, Viola wanted to protest. "It's the new 40.
But she didn't have any protest left in her. She had an alarming vision of the hens continuing the party in her room, but eventually she managed to persuade them to leave her at the door to the lift. The mother of the bride pressed something into her hand, a tiny tissue-wrapped gift.
"Valium," the mother said, "but just take a half. They're high strength. I've built up a tolerance."
A still teary Viola hiccuped her gratitude. In the refuge of her room, she forewent her usual nightly routine, makeup off, teeth cleaned, hair brushed, and instead crawled wearily between sheets that were snapping with starch, and recklessly washed down a whole Valium with two little bottles of vodka from the minibar. She feared nightmares, but instead she fell into a surprisingly delicious sleep. Golden slumbers kissed her eyes, silver moths flitted around her head, and she dreamed a powerful dream. She woke early, showered, dressed, ordered a large pot of coffee and assessed the damage. She felt as if she had been, if not in a war, then certainly in a bloody skirmish. What else did she feel? She checked herself all over. Her wrists felt mildly sprained, and her knees were horribly stiff and sore, as if someone had hammered them all night. Her head felt stuffed with wool, the mother of the bride's Valium, she supposed, but otherwise intact. Then she looked inside herself. "Completely fucked," she concluded. She checked out, relieved that there was no sign of the staff who had witnessed her humiliating fall from grace last night. How were the sluts this morning, she wondered. Hopelessly hungover, probably still asleep. Although actually they were helping themselves enthusiastically to an eat-all-you-can full English buffet breakfast in a superior travel lodge and getting ready to rampage through Primark. They were from Gateshead. They had stamina. Viola asked the doorman for a taxi to Poplar Hill. Spending the day with her father would be penance for last night. She would watch the Diamond Jubilee with him for extra contrition. Her father was clearly exhausted, sleeping almost all the time now like an aged dog. Why didn't he just go? Was he hanging on for 100? 2 more years of this? It was mere existence. An amoeba had more life. "The triumph of the human spirit," the new nursing sister said, new enough to talk about positive outcomes and enhancement programs. Emollient management speak, meaningless to most of the residents of Poplar Hill, who were either dying or demented, or both. It was called a care home. But there was precious little of either to be had when you were run by a profit-based healthcare provider employing minimum-wage staff. And, by the way, neither Poplar nor Hill were anywhere to be seen. This was a particular bugbear, which Viola found herself bringing up at regular intervals, when really it was the least of her criticisms, and just made her seem like another madwoman to the mainly foreign care workers. Polish and Tagalog spoken, it said in the Poplar Hill brochure.
"It's so stuffy in here," she said to Teddy.
He muttered something that might have been agreement. The heating was turned up impossibly high, intensifying the loathsome smells that made you gag the minute you walked into the building, and helpfully incubating the millions of germs that must be circulating. There were the usual animal odours of urine and faeces, as well as the reek of something rotted and spoiled that no amount of disinfectant could cover up. The scent of old age, Viola presumed. When she visited Poplar Hill, she kept a handkerchief up her sleeve doused in Chanel that she sniffed occasionally, like a nosegay against the plague. The doors to the rooms were kept open, so that each room was a little vignette, the wreckage inside on display, like some awful zoo or a museum of horrors. Some people lay in bed and barely moved, while others moaned and shouted. Then there were those who were propped in chairs, their heads lolling on their chests like sleeping toddlers, and somewhere, unseen, a woman was meowing like a cat. As you walked along the corridors, you had to slalom around the walking wounded, as Viola thought of them, the lost souls who simply shuffled up and down all day, with no idea who they were or where they were going. Nowhere, clearly. None of them knew the code for the security keypad on the locked door of the wing. 1234. How hard could it be? And if they had known, they couldn't have remembered. And if they could have remembered, it would still have been meaningless because their brains were full of holes, like lace. Occasionally, Viola had found them gathered, like zombies. Slow ones. They weren't going to be chasing anyone, paid or not. At the door, staring mutely through the wire glass at a world that was forbidden to them now. They were prisoners, serving the lees of their life sentences. The walking dead. To intensify the unpleasant atmosphere of the wing, there was a blaring cacophony of competing televisions coming from every room, all with the volume turned up high. Deal or No Deal trying to shout down Escape to the Country, and no one really caring what they watched, because they couldn't make sense of any of it. There was always a buzzer going off somewhere, long and insistent, as a resident tried to get the attention of someone, anyone. There was also a communal lounge, where residents were parked in front of an even bigger, louder television set. For reasons Viola couldn't fathom, the lounge also contained a large cage that imprisoned a pair of lovebirds that no one ever paid any attention to. She had disliked Fanning Court, the sheltered housing complex that she had cajoled her father into almost 20 years ago now, but compared to the nursing home, oh, sorry, care home, it was a lost Eden.
"Why, this is hell,"
she said conversationally to her father. "Nor am I out of it, and nor are you." She smiled brightly at a care assistant going past the open door. Who in their right mind could think that euthanasia was a bad thing? Shipman had spoiled it for everyone. But however awful it was in Poplar Hill, it meant that Viola didn't have to be the one who coped, who changed nappies and spoon-fed pap, and tried to think of ways to entertain in the long hours in between. She had never been much good at that stuff with her children, so it seemed unlikely she would develop the skills now for someone at the other end of life. She just wasn't cut out to look after others. Viola imagined herself as someone whose insides were made of a hard substance, as if soft organs and tissue had calcified at some point in the long-ago past. The petrification of Viola Romaine. Good title for something. Her life, she supposed. But who would write it, and how could she stop them? To be honest, with herself at any rate, she didn't really like people.
"L'enfer, c'est les autres."
Viola Romaine laughs lightly. Yet this is clearly not true, as she writes with great sympathy about the human condition. Red Magazine, 2011. In her defence, Viola frequently thought of herself in the third person, as if presenting herself to a jury. In her defence, she was regularly moved to tears these days by tales of cruelty to animals, which, if nothing else, proved she wasn't a sociopath. The jury was reserving judgment. If you read the tabloids, which Viola did, "Important to know the enemy," she would have said to the jury, but actually the red tops were a much better read than the smugly self-satisfied broadsheets. It seemed as though there were people all over the place who were starving horses to death, or putting puppies into tumble dryers, or popping kittens into microwaves, as though they were snacks. These stories left Viola in a state of unresolved horror that wasn't quite matched by how she felt about, for example, cruelty to children. She had to keep this fact to herself. It was a taboo, like voting Tory. Not even Gregory, her therapist, knew. Especially not Gregory, as he would have had a field day with it. Her Secret Self, How to Hide Your True Nature, by Viola Romaine. Her excuse, did she need one? yes, probably, was that she had been exiled from love after her mother died.
After I lost my wife,
was the way her father would have put it, as if he had accidentally mislaid Nancy. Exile from Love, that was the title of one of Viola's early novels. A poignant tale of struggle and loss, according to Woman's Own. That was where the best of her was to be found, in her books. Almost as good as Jodie Picou, Mumsnet. Her readers, almost exclusively women, and she had many, devoted, etc., all thought she was a nice, nay wonderful, person. It was alarming. It made her feel guilty, as if she had made promises that she could never live up to. She had been making this visit to Poplar Hill every week for 3 years now, and would have been quite happy never to set foot in the place, but didn't want to be seen as neglectful. Viola derived no pleasure from being with her father. She had always been wary of him, for one reason or another, but now that he was a wreck, more child than Colossus, he felt like an utter stranger. The Ancient Mariner was lucky. His albatross was already dead before it was hung round his neck. She had come from Harrogate by train today because she was on her way to somewhere else. She made a mental note. On the way to somewhere else. Good title. Harrogate was the kind of place that won Britain in Bloom competitions, and where what poverty there was swept neatly out of sight. Viola still harboured a regret that she had never made it beyond the borders of Yorkshire, never lived a London life, sophisticated and metropolitan, or so she imagined. Her brief sojourn in a squat with deadbeat Dominic hardly counted. That had been in Islington, before it was fashionable, and she had hardly left the house.
Postnatal depression, she told people afterwards.
A legitimate badge of suffering to parade, although really it was just straightforward depression.
I think I was born depressed, she tells Psychology's magazine. I think it's given me a greater understanding of people.
If she lived in London these days, she would be invited to parties, to lunches and do's. She sold too well, international bestseller, to be embraced by the glitterati, but it would be nice not to feel that she was a populist barbarian knocking on the gates.
I'm a northerner and proud of it.
Daily Express interview, March 2006. Was she? Not really. She would rather have been brought up in the plush home counties at Fox Corner, semi-mythical now in her memory, everyone's memory. She was 6 when Sylvie died and the house was sold. Her mother's childhood home, Jackdaws, followed a few years later, where Mrs. Shawcross succumbed to genteel senility and lived out her days in Dorset with the tolerant Gertie. It was her father's fault. He had chosen to settle up here after the war. She had never asked why. Too late now. Too late for everything. The Queen sailed on heroically through wind and rain.
Her Diamond Jubilee, Viola said to Teddy. She's been on the throne for 60 years. That's a long time. Can you remember her coronation?
Viola was barely a year old when the Queen was crowned, and had never known another monarch. She would see Charles ascend to the throne, she supposed, possibly William, if she lived long enough. But she wouldn't see that fat baby become George VII. Life was finite. Civilizations rose and fell, and in the end everything was dust and sand, even that fat royal baby. Nothing beside remained. Hotels, maybe. Viola fell into an admittedly self-indulgent existential gloom, and was only pulled out of it when her father started to choke. She panicked and tried to help him sit up. There was hardly any water in the jug on his table, even though it was supposed to be kept topped up. The residents, a ridiculous word, as they had chosen to live here, were probably all suffering from dehydration, not to mention starvation. 3 nutritious meals a day, it said on the Poplar Hill website. There were menus pinned to a notice board every day. Shepherd's pie, fish and sauté potatoes, chicken casserole. They made it sound like real food, when in fact every meal that Viola had seen was a kind of beige slop and jelly for afters. Her father didn't seem to eat any more, a breatharian by default. Viola had been briefly, very briefly, obviously, attracted to breatharianism, as she was to all things cultish. Living on air had seemed like a good way to lose weight. It was an absurd idea, and in her defence, she turned to the jury, she had been going through a particularly bad patch in her life. That was before she discovered that all you had to do to lose weight was to eat less. Svelte, according to the Mail on Sunday, and still the proud possessor of a good pair of pins, even though she's got a bus pass now. She hadn't. She took taxis and chauffeur-driven cars, and she would have preferred it if the good had been great. Viola poured the dregs of the water jug into a plastic cup and stirred in the thickener that turned any liquid into disgusting gloop but was supposed to prevent her father from choking. She held the cup to his lips so that he could take a sip of the gloop. "Do you find old age in itself repellent?" Gregory asked. "Or just your father's?"
"Both," she said.
"And your own?"
"Yes, all right." She was terrified of growing old.
"You are old," Bertie said. Was this going to be her fate, too, when she reached the endgame? Lunch clubs and chairs for the elderly, and then finally being administered gloop by someone who spoke Tagalog, not someone who truly cared. "You reap what you sow," her father used to say. Bertie certainly wouldn't take her in. Perhaps she could go and live in Bali with Sonny. He was a Buddhist. His religion obliged him to be compassionate, didn't it?
"It's more a state of mind than a religion," Bertie said.
"Imagine if that was a law, and everyone had to obey it. Smiley, concerned faces everywhere asking if you were all right. Would it be utopian, or just rather irritating?" It was 10 years since she had seen Sonny. A decade. How had that happened? What kind of mother let a decade go by without seeing her child? She had tried a couple of times over the years, when she was on a book tour in Australia, for instance, but he said he was going to be in Thailand while she was there. Perhaps she could stop off in Thailand on the way out, she suggested. He was hiking in the north. She wouldn't be able to get to him, he said.
"I wouldn't call that trying hard," Bertie said.
"Righteous, like her grandfather, of course."
"You gave him up," Bertie said.
It was true. She had handed him over to the vile Villas.
"But in my defence..."
But the members of the jury were not listening. The Spirit of Chartwell had moored near Tower Bridge. "The Queen stopped," Viola informed her father. "It's still raining cats and dogs. You in particular would admire her stoicism if you could see her." He mumbled something. It sounded as if his mouth was full of stones. He could no longer see well enough to watch television, and even if he had been able to see, he found it difficult to connect one moment to the next, as if everything fragmented in the moment of trying to hold on to it. Books were out of the question. Before the last bout of pneumonia, when he'd still been able to see large print books, she discovered that he'd been reading the first chapter of Barchester Towers over and over again, looping round and coming to it fresh each time. Perhaps his brain was becoming economical with time, conserving what little was left as it approached its last days. But time was an artificial construct, wasn't it? Zeno's arrow staggering and stuttering its way to some fictional endpoint in the future. In reality, that arrow had no target. They weren't on a journey, and there was no final destination where everything would suddenly fall transcendentally into place, the mysteries revealed. They were all just lost souls, wandering the halls, gathering silently at the exit. No promised land, no paradise regained. "It's also pointless," she said to her father, but he seemed to have nodded off. Viola sighed and replaced the untouched gloop on his overbed table. "And now it's just boats, ships, passing in front of her. All kinds of different ones.
Quite boring ones.
Viola's phone rang.
Bertie, the screen said.
Viola thought about not answering.
Answered.
Are you watching the Thames pageant with Grandpa Ted?
Bertie asked.
Yes, I'm in his room.
It's rubbish, isn't it? And the poor Queen, she's almost as old as Grandpa Ted, and she's having to suffer all this.
She'll catch her death in all that rain,
Viola said.
She had spouted socialism and republicanism most of her adult life, but lately had revealed a strange affection for the royal family, and she had voted Tory in the last election, although it would have taken torture to drag that fact out into the open.
In my defence, it was a tactical vote, she explained to the jury. They were not convinced.
UKIP was still beyond the pale, but never say never.
People didn't mellow in old age. They simply decomposed, as far as Viola could see.
Anyway, Bertie said, indicating she had already run out of things to say to her mother, can you put me on to Grandpa Ted?
He won't understand you.
Just put me on, anyway.
If Viola could start again... There are no second chances. Life's not a rehearsal, blah, blah, blah. Yes, but if she could... If she could retake the journey that wasn't really a journey, what would she do? She would learn how to love.
Learning to love. A painful but ultimately redemptive journey... displaying warmth and compassion as the author learns how to overcome loneliness and despair. The steps she takes to mend her relationship with her children are particularly rewarding. Half the members of the jury had nodded off by now. She had tried, she really had. She had worked on herself. Years of therapy and fresh starts, although nothing that really required an effort on her part. She wanted someone else to effect change in her. It seemed a shame you couldn't just get an injection that would suddenly make everything all right.
Try heroin, Bertie said.
She hadn't turned to the church yet, but now that she had voted Tory, tactical, Anglicanism would probably be next. But it didn't seem to matter how many new beginnings she had. Viola always somehow found herself in the same place, and no matter how hard she tried, the earliest template of herself always seemed to trump later versions. So why bother, really?
Pointless, she said again, as she tried to open the window further.
But it had a lock that prevented it moving more than a couple of inches, as if the powers that be were trying to prevent elves falling out, rather than normal-sized, if slightly shrunken, old people. They were on the first floor, and the view was of the huge industrial bins that contained God knows what kind of unpalatable refuse. Her father must miss having fresh air. He had always been so into the outdoors. He loved nature. She felt a sudden spark of sympathy for him, and stamped on it. When she was a child, they drove out to the country nearly every weekend, and walked for miles while he battered her with information about flowers and animals and trees. Oh, God, how she had hated those nature walks. He wrote a column for years for some obscure rural magazine. Of course, if she had listened to him, she might have learned some useful stuff. But she didn't listen on principle, because there was nothing he could ever say about anything that would make up for his losing her mother.
I want my mother.
The desperate cry of a child in the night.
Oh, for God's sake, get over it, Bertie said,
unnecessarily harsh, in Viola's opinion.
You used the word wary earlier, in the context of your father,
Gregory said. He was yet another incarnation of the voice of reason, of course, a voice that had been pursuing her all her life.
Wary? He prompted her. Did I use that word?
Yes. She supposed he was trying to truffle out abuse or something equally traumatic and dramatic. But it was her father's provident character that had made her want to keep her distance from him. His stoicism, yes, that much overused word, his cheerful frugality,
the bees, the chickens, the home-grown vegetables. Chores had to be done.
I'll wash if you dry.
Leftovers had to be used up.
Well, let's see, there's a bit of ham and some cold potatoes in the fridge. Why don't you pop outside and see if our feathered friends have given us any eggs?
And his persistent patience with her, as if she were a mulish dog.
Come on now, Viola, if you come and sit down and do your homework, we'll see if we can't find you a treat afterwards.
You sound sensible, Viola.
You're supposed to be on my side.
Sensible. What a horrid word.
Am I?
Gregory said mildly. Was there no one who would ever sympathize with her tales of woe, even people that she paid a fortune to precisely for that task?
And he cut my hair off after my mother died.
Himself?
No, he took me to a hairdresser.
Nancy used to take her to Swallow and Barry in Stonegate, and then they would go to Betty's and eat meringues filled with cream. She had ordered a meringue in Betty's last night. It was very good, but it was not the meringue perdue of her childhood. Swallow and Barry had a little counter downstairs where they sold jewelled tortoiseshell combs and clips, and it smelt of some lovely grown-up perfume, and upstairs the hairdresser always said how nice her long hair was, and then he trimmed the ends neatly so it would be even nicer. It was a place of luxury and indulgence, where people told her she was pretty and everyone loved Nancy. But after she died, her father said he couldn't do her plaits every morning, and she needed something more manageable. So he took her to a horrible little salon near where they lived. It was painted lilac, the sort of place that nowadays would be called a cut above, or curls, but then was called Jennifer's. And she clearly remembered that it was cold, and the mauve paint was peeling. She left with an awful short style that didn't suit her, made her look like a plain pudding, her lost hair abandoned on the cracked lino of Jennifer's. No meringues in Betty's, only lemon barley water and chocolate bourbons at home. She had wept and wept and...
Couldn't you brush your own hair?
I'm sorry?
Couldn't you brush your own hair?
I was 9 years old, so no, not properly. Nancy had brushed her hair attentively every morning and every evening before bed. It had been a lovely communion that they shared. Bertie had long hair when she was small, by default, really, as Viola had never taken her to a hairdresser. Viola remembered rushing to get her children off to school in the mornings, always an appalling hour of chaos, with Bertie being slow and Sunny being obnoxious.
"Why don't you get up a bit earlier?"
her father suggested. Right, as if she got enough sleep as it was. Bertie hated the ritual tug-of-war with the little Mason and Pearson, a brush that wasn't really up to the task. She fidgeted endlessly and yowled when the brush snagged, so she usually went off to school with it sticking out all over the place. It was a Steiner school. All the children arrived looking vaguely unkempt, so it didn't seem to matter that much. Viola winced at a long-forgotten memory that resurfaced unexpectedly, yelling at Bertie,
"Well, brush it yourself if you're not prepared to stand still,"
before throwing the brush across the room. How old was Bertie then? 6? 7? Oh, Viola. This memory, coming out of the blue, was another little jab to Viola's heart, already severely damaged by the previous evening's revels.
"Was I really such a terrible mother?"
she asked Bertie.
"Why the past tense?"
Bertie said. "Sow and reap." Another jab. The fissure in Viola's ossified heart widened into a crevasse. Jab, jab. Of course, it wasn't that people didn't love her, although it certainly felt as if they didn't. She hadn't been exiled from love. She had exiled herself. She wasn't stupid, she knew that. What was the next step, then? The voice of reason asked. Was it perhaps to begin...
Oh, shut the fuck up,
Viola said wearily. When Bertie went to stay with Viola's father...
I lived with him. I didn't stay with him.
True to precedent, He took her to a hairdresser, and she returned with an old-fashioned bob held back with a plastic hair slide. She loved it, she reported, but Viola suspected that she only said that to annoy her.
She can look after it herself now, her father said.
He was obsessed with self-sufficiency, of course, with people being responsible for themselves. He started to snore.
I'm still interested in the word wary, Gregory said.
Viola sighed.
Maybe it was the wrong word.
Everyone liked her father. He was good. He was kind. She had watched him kill her mother.
Do you want to talk about that, Viola?
The insubstantial pageant started to drizzle limply to an end, and a pair of carers came into the room and said,
Ready for bed, Ted?
Like a children's rhyme. He's already in bed, Viola pointed out, and the carers laughed as if she'd said something funny. They were both Filipino, Tagalog spoken here, and laughed no matter what you said. Were the Philippines really such a happy place, or were the carers just happy not to be there? Or did they not understand a word she said? It was only 6 o'clock. Even his bedtime was that of a little boy. One of them was carrying an adult nappy, and they waited silently for her to leave the room. Preserving the dignity of our residents is of paramount importance. Once her father had been cleaned up and tucked in, Viola went back to say goodbye.
I won't be here next week, she said,
although it seemed pointless to talk to him about anything that involved the future. Pointless to talk to him about anything, really.
I'm not going home, she added. I'm going to a literary festival in Singapore.
He said something. It could have been sunny.
Yes, it will be hot, she said,
even though she knew that wasn't what he meant. Sun. Sun. Sunny. It was just a hop and a skip from Singapore to Bali, Bertie said. If she was already going that far, why wasn't Viola going to see her only son? And Bertie called her a passive-aggressive. It was 4 hours, actually. But it wasn't the time or the distance, unless you thought of those things as metaphorical, which Viola did.
Right, well, I'll be off now. Viola said, glancing with relief at her watch. I've got a taxi book to pick me up.
She kissed Teddy lightly on the forehead, the proximity of escape making her almost affectionate. He was cool and dry to the touch, already half embalmed and mummified. His hand twitched, but that was the only acknowledgement he gave her. Downstairs, at the main exit door, an old woman, one of the walking dead, was treading water, looking out at what would have made quite a nice garden for the residents if it hadn't been given over to staff parking. Viola recognized her as someone called Agnes. She had still been in possession of her mind when her father first moved to Poplar Hill and used to sit in his room and chat to him. Now she had the dead stare of a fish and was fluent in gibberish.
Hello there,
Viola said pleasantly. Experience had taught her that it was difficult to converse with someone whose eyes slid past you as if you were the ghost, not them, but she pressed on.
Would you mind moving? She said. I'd like to leave, and you are a bit in the way.
Agnes said something, but it was like listening to Bertie talking in her sleep.
You're not allowed out, Viola said, trying to nudge her out of the way.
But Agnes stood her ground, immovable as a cow or a horse. Viola sighed and said,
Be it on your own head, then,
and keyed in the magic exit number on the security pad. 4321. Agnes slipped swiftly out, her speediness impressive, already halfway down the drive by the time Viola was climbing into her taxi. You had to admire her fugitive spirit. The new nursing sister came jogging awkwardly out of the building and said to Viola,
You haven't seen Agnes, have you?
Viola shrugged and said,
Sorry.
She caught the last train to London and missed the sub-headline in the press the next day. The news item was buried amongst photos of the weekend street parties and reports of the Jubilee celebrations, and Viola did not read that an 80-year-old resident of a care home who suffers from Alzheimer's disease has been reported missing. She was spotted by a motorist